Hello, I'm Oliver Wong, and you're listening to Heat Rocks. In honor of J. Dilla's birthday, who would have turned 47 this week, we've put together a medley episode that features our conversations on some of Dilla's most iconic albums. First up, we have music writer Nate Patron talking to us about Dilla's final album, Donuts. Nate, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be on the show.
So why don't we begin with the question of how did you first get introduced to JD himself?
That's a good question because I started really hearing his stuff, just his earliest productions, pretty much as they came out, because he first really started getting nationwide attention, I believe, for the work he did on the Far Side's 95 album, Lab Cabin California.
Yeah.
So if you've, you know, ever seen that, you know, backwards walking video for Drop, which is, you know, a classic of the, I believe that was the Spike Jonze video filmography. That's, you know, that was a Dilla beat.
I want to come to Morgan's initial impressions of JD in that moment. Just to share mine, I had certainly been aware of his name thanks to the work that he did, as we've been talking about, on Far Side and De La. And, sorry, not De La. Well, actually, I guess De La as well, but really Tribe and Far Side initially in the mid-90s. But I did not get a sense of the kind of like, oh my God, you need to hear this person, until the Slum Village album began to make its initial rounds. And this was before the kind of tortured history around why that initial debut LP got pushed back by a number of years. But it was just like, I felt like, you know, this was probably, if I have the timeline right, maybe like the early years where the OK Player message board and website was beginning to blow up and creating a community of like-minded listeners. And Dilla, from an relatively early, maybe not right out the gate, but kind of in that early end of his first act, beginning of his second act part of his career, there was such a kind of reverence that people had for him. He was kind of one of those your favorite producer type situations, which is why when I finally was able to hear the first Slum Village album, I got to interview the group. And so I got a copy of the advance. I think my expectations were set so high that it was almost inevitable that I was going to be let down a little bit by it, because I don't know what exactly I was expecting, but I was expecting to have my mind blown in the way that, let's say, the best premiere beats might do, because those things are like in your face. You think about like the Bomb Squad and that kind of wall of sound that we've talked about on the show. That's not Dilla's style. And so I wasn't really anticipating this sort of softness to it, but as time has gone by, and we'll definitely come back to this point later, that's exactly what I began to appreciate the most about Dilla's, the subtlety of his production. It's the 788, D-10, just like Jake the Snake. Morgan, how about you? What was your original introduction to JD, and what were your impressions of him?
I really started to pay attention to his production style around Mama's Gun. Mama's Gun was a point where I was like, okay, this is some, to me, sort of the marriage between lo-fi, rare grooves, and neo-soul. It's the intersection. And this is the dude behind sort of that. He's giving something to the sound. He's giving a warmth and a texture. That's when I really started to be like, okay, I know this is a larger Soulquarians thing, but there's a visionary behind the Soulquarians. He's the one that's showing up with the records.
I don't recall if I knew a lot about Donuts in terms of what it was about prior to just sitting down and listening to it. And I think my initial impression was, wait, this is just a beat tape. And for me, I think it certainly gained resonance beyond that, because it was obviously the last thing that JD put out before he passed away. But it took me, I think, a while to, in a way, I guess, hear it for it being beyond just, okay, here's a bunch of beats that Dilla put together, which in truth, I mean, that is also what it is. It is a bunch of beats that Dilla put together, but it in a lot of ways is more than that. And I think for more reasons than just that, it is his last effort. I think there are other layers there. And I really enjoyed reading a lot of that back history in Nate's book about what makes this more than just like your average B tape. So, Nate, do you want to talk a little bit about, number one, your impressions of Donut for yourself, but also some of the ways in which you think this is a B tape, but yet not, or at least more than?
I wasn't like, you know, in the line for Donut's release day, but at the time, it didn't seem that different to some of the other stuff I was really checking with, you know, checking for, particularly around Stone's Throw, like the Mad Lib Beat Conductor series.
Yeah.
And I'd find out, you know, well, and this was like a couple of years after the Champion Sound record. So by at that point, I'd kind of like gotten the sense, oh yeah, Mad Lib, Dilla, they're kind of like, you know, operating in the same, you know, maybe not necessarily the same lane, but in, you know, adjacent lanes on the same freeway. And since I was like really into these, you know, Beat Conductor records, Donuts just slotted in right along the same way. And then the more I learned about the recording process and what it took to actually put this album together, the more I started to hear all these different elements in it that spoke to the experience of making it and the condition in which Dilla made it. Like, it wasn't entirely made in the hospital. I know it's, like you mentioned, it was a beat tape. It started out as like I think it was just like 22 minutes, and, you know, Peanut Butter Wolf of Stone's Throw heard it and was just losing his mind over it, and like got into, you know, Dilla's ear, and, you know, Egon, the general manager at Stones, are saying, okay, you got to make this into a longer thing and put it out as an album because this is good. It's almost like an experimental record that caught fire. They're like sketches, but they're very expressive sketches. She used to whip me with a strap when I was bad.
We talk a little bit about just Dilla's production approach in general, and not to say that it's monolithic by any means, but really to get at the heart of what made it so memorable. And I think more than most other, or maybe any other hip hop producer I can think of, it's that Dilla understood the importance of infusing his productions with some level of emotional affect. And I know this may sound simplistic since most people want to make beats that make you feel something, but to me, Dilla's techniques went beyond just the kind of boom bap impact that a good beat has on your body or on your eardrums. I certainly don't think all of his beats were about affect. You know, sometimes he just liked to make a sick track to bounce to, but to me, his best productions, the ones that are most memorable are the ones that evoke this deep sense of melancholy. And one of my favorite examples is actually one of his earliest productions, which is the remix to Far Side's She Said. If there was a melancholy hall of fame for hip hop beats, this would have to be someplace, you know, first ballot in that respect. And I think you can hear some of those similar resonances on many of the beats on Donuts. And the one that immediately comes to mind, which doesn't sound anything like that She Said remix, but still has a sense of melancholy, is the last song on the album, which is, some people call it the Donuts intro. It's also known as Welcome to the Show, which uses this really unexpected 6/8 loop from the group Motherlode.
Mentioning melancholy as part of his production, I just wanted to add that there are quite a few melancholy moments to me on Donuts. And I say melancholy to me because they're songs that pain me, that hurt me to listen to, just because I know what his situation is. One of them is Waves. I don't know whatever the reason is, but whenever I get to get to that song, I need a moment. It's the song that makes me the saddest on this album. To me, it's so mournful. And I'm not sure what the sample is for that.
It's from a 10cc song, I believe, Johnny Don't Do It.
And then the other one is By. What a flip of the Isley Brothers.
I wanna love you.
I like what Common did later on it, I think with on The Shining, that album.
Let go and let me live inside you. With your mouth, don't say baby, your thighs do. I want us to arrive together. I love it when the weather is wet and sticky.
I think what he was able to do with samples and with records is as much science as it is art. And speaking of that, one of the interviews I found was Erica sitting down with our friend Egon to talk about Dilla and his work, particularly his process on Mama's Gun.
I met him through Common. Common and he were good friends. And I went to Detroit because I wanted him to be on my album. And we went in the basement, and every wall from floor to ceiling was records categorized. He was a scientist. Like, if you open his refrigerator, all the Coke cans were turned the same way. It looked like a graveyard. It was perfect. You know, everything was perfect. But he let me pick out some records. And there are so many records I had never heard before in my life. One was a Tarika Blue record. Didn't you know? And not only did he let me pick the record, he let me pick the spot in the record and taught me how to sample the portion of the song. That's where I got my first sampling lesson from Dilla.
Well, let's take this deep back into Donuts itself. And as always, we're going to start with the tough question, especially in an album that had this many tracks. What is the fire track? And Nate, as you are our guest, I'm going to put you in the hot seat first.
Wow. I mean, it almost seems like the kind of the cop-out answer because it's the one track that actually has that sort of song length feel to it. But working on it really does feel like a fantastic way to transition from the sort of introductory aspect of the record to the rest, because it's, you know, it's the longest track, but it's got all these funny little like deeks or loop fakes. Like I kind of mentioned how he kind of just completely messes with the preconceptions and ideas of how a loop is supposed to play out on a song, so that it's a standout track that's also kind of like the introduction to the world you're about to find yourself immersed in.
By me.
Morgan, how about you?
I'm working on a project now, a forthcoming film, and have been going back and forth on a scene where the creative brief says, find a scene for this character where in the film she's asked, what's the song that you'd go deaf to? And for me, the song on Donuts that I'd risk my hearing for is Work On It.
This was a tough choice, again, because there's so many songs to choose from and so many beats on here are fire. So trying to narrow it down to just one is rough. If I had to pick an honorable mention, I would have gone with MASH because of those Galt McDermott piano melodies.
Mm.
But in terms of just pure, let me go out and just start setting stuff on fire, I got to go with Geek Down. I yes. think it's possibly the hardest beat I associate with Dilla, this side of his Fuck the Police beat.
Oh,
and yeah. on this album in particular, Geek Down is just that straight up punch to the face.
Yeah, that's definitely in the running for one of my favorite tracks. But it's also, I like to think about the choice of sample. It's this group. It's Adrian Utley and Jeff Barrow from Portishead basically doing this B-side called Charlie's Theme that sounds like a sort of exploitation film theme from the 70s. Sometimes you don't need to do something super complicated to really bring out the most in a source.
Do you have a favorite sample on the Donuts album? And also, which song on this album shows best the whole of J. Dilla as a producer?
I really do think the Jackson 5 song that was sampled for Time the Donut of the Heart, that sitar loop. And then kind of time shifts somewhere in the middle. So he really stretches it out. I think it's a kind of partially a little technical effect and also a bit of a little emotional jolt too.
Morgan, how about you? How would you answer your own question?
The answer to my question is also my favorite moment. One of my favorite moments on the album is the change in tempo and temperature on Don't Cry. Because on that song, it feels like the lead vocal and the background vocals are two people in a relationship.
Mm. This has popped into my mind, but one of the things that I really appreciate about the tracks on Donuts is in particular their brevity. I mean, we've talked a lot about actually just in terms of how relatively short these things are. You have some things on this that are, well under a minute and very few things that are over two. And there is sometimes I think a desire to just, you want more from it. Like it ends too soon. And I very rarely ever feel that about anything I hear on Donuts. I feel like they're exactly as long as they need to be. And not a moment longer and not a moment shorter. And it's, I think that's a tough thing to pull off, especially with so many terse tracks. I mean, I suppose it helps is they are for the most part, purely instrumental, even though you have voices being sampled. It makes it a little bit easier to hear them shorter because you're not expecting like a 16 or 32 bar verse from somebody. But nonetheless, just the ultimate brevity of it, I think, works really well. And especially because the only medium that I have this album on, I don't have it on CD or LP. I have it on cassette. And this is a really great album to listen to on cassette. for whatever reason, and I guess I could try to think through why, but for me, it just works really well. Maybe because I know it started as a beat tape, so to literally listen to it on cassette tape kind of makes sense. But I think the brevity of it also works with the medium very well.
Yeah, it can fit on a single side of a C90, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Shout out to cassettes, though.
Yeah.
Nate, if you had to describe donuts in three words, what would you choose?
Loops as memories.
We'll be back with more of our JD Medley episode after some words from our Sibling Max Fun podcast. Keep it locked.
I'm Jesse Thorne. On the next Bullseye, we've got the one and only Ted Danson. We'll talk about his new show, Mr. Mayor, about Cheers, and about the secret to success in comedy.
I mean, I feel like one of your signature comedic moves at this point in your career is gazing. You do a lot of interesting gazing.
I also love this. Gazing. I love that. And if I'm not, I'm going to start, because that's great.
That's Bullseye. Find it on MaximumFun.org, NPR.org, and wherever you get podcasts.
Hey there, beautiful people. Did you hear that good, good news?
Something about the baby Jesus?
He's coming back.
Or do you mean the fact that Apple Podcasts has named Fanti one of the best shows of 2020?
I mean, we already knew that we was hot stuff, but a little external validation never hurts, okay?
Hosted by me, writer and journalist Jared Hill.
And me, the ebony enchantress myself, Javel Anderson.
Fanti is your home for complex conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the people, places, and things we're huge fans of, but got some anti-feelings toward.
You name it, we Fanti. Nobody's off limits.
Check us out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your slayworthy audio.
And we are back on Heat Rocks with our J. Dilla medley episode. Next up, it's our conversation with music exec and writer Dan Charnas about Slum Village's Fantastic Volume 2. It's part of the plan. You setting it up. You blind and stuff. That's right. You do it for the love, cause you buckling up. My Nicholas motherfucker ready to. The ass is genuine. You envision the grind. She's already with it. You just spend a dime. See, nah. Dan, it is such a pleasure to finally have you on. Welcome to Heat Rocks.
Man, I'm honored. Absolutely honored. Thank you for having me.
So, Fantastic Volume 2. What makes this a Heat Rock for you?
Well, you know, it's one of this category of unsung albums in pop music. You know, it was not successful in its time. It was delayed for 2 years in its release and almost did not come out. And you tell a little bit of that story and we can tell some more. It was tepidly reviewed by the rap publications of its time. But the influence it had far outweighed our ability to even catalog it. In many ways, I liken it to the Velvet Underground's first album in 1967, of which it has been said, you know, they only sold 10,000 copies, but every single one of those 10,000 people started a band.
Yeah, right.
So for Fantastic, I sort of feel the same way about it in the sense that it is a super important cultural and musicological document, mostly because it represents the birth of a new approach to musical time.
All right, you're going to have to unpack that. So what is this birth of a new musical time that you're referring to?
Okay, so we generally think of rhythm as sort of a straight pulse, right? One, two, three, four, or one, two, three. One, two, three. In rhythm, especially in the European tradition, every pulse is even, right? Of course, because we're measuring time, right? So you don't want a clock that speeds up and slows down, Well, our time sense is even. It's straight. That's what we call straight time. When the Europeans first started to explore and colonize and enslave West Africans, they encountered different approaches to rhythm. One that would you could call polyrhythmic, meaning two even pulses of different denominations going at the same time. So, for example, if I'm banging out a two on my right chest, I'll bang out a three on the left side. So it's one, two, one, two. That's a polyrhythm, right? That is very foreign to the European ear. And when Africans were brought to the Americas, that polyrhythm survived in South America and in the Caribbean, but it did not really survive in North America. And at this point, I have to very much credit my colleague Jeff Peretz, you know, who has done a lot of thinking about this and teaches it this way, is that in North America, essentially, we have just the ghosts of polyrhythm in our music. One of those ghosts is called syncopation, which is the placement of a note where we don't expect it to be because it doesn't conform to our idea of pulse. You know, I often think of, when I think of syncopation, I think of Prince's guitar playing in Lady Cab Driver. That is a very syncopated way of approaching the guitar. His notes come in places that we don't normally expect them, and that's the delight of it. But then there's this other remnant, and that remnant is swing, right? Which is a different way of approaching rhythm, right? Instead of even, it's uneven. It is a remnant of polyrhythm. And essentially, instead of a straight rhythm, you get this. And most all of American popular music, or popular music, is informed by swing.
So how does this all relate to where I know you're taking this, which is about Dilla time?
So J. Dilla, starting essentially, although he had been playing with these ideas before Fantastic Volume 2, J. Dilla on Fantastic Volume 2 was the first to essentially jam different types of straight and swung rhythms simultaneously against each other, putting them in conflict, to give this sort of herky-jerky feeling that really did not exist in our popular music before and would in the next few years with the Soulquarians and other hip-hop producers, and then over the next, you know, after his death, essentially influence the way that musicians approach their instruments and think about musical time. So it is, I view it as sort of a third way of relating to musical time. It's not straight, it's not swung, it's the collision of straight and swung. The first way that he started playing with time was deceleration of samples, right? So you're a vinyl native person. If you have a single that's on 45 RPM and you slow it down to 33, what happens? What do you hear?
It gets, you know,
and everybody, every musician, even the greatest musicians have timing errors. When you slow a sample down, the errors elongate.
Yeah.
And he was fascinated by this sound, and you hear it all throughout this album. So his first tool was deceleration, and a perfect example is in the very first track of the album called Conan Gardens, where he slows down this sample of it's a song called A Tribute to Wes by Little Beaver. And you can just hear the errors in that hi-hat coming way out and elongating. So much faster, right? So that incredible kick drum and that cracking snare are nailed to the grid, but that hi-hat just sort of goes back and forth between those two.
Get down. down with it. You can't fathom these brothers fantastic, huh? I heard you cry when I dipped that ass in some plastic, huh? How could you master genuine rapping bastards, bastards? Because you asked us if we could bring you.
Another great example of this deceleration is this famous song Players on this album, where he has two decelerated samples at once. The first is a song called Claire by Singers Unlimited.
Seem a lifetime away, oh Claire, Claire. Claire.
And then the drums are an incredibly decelerated sample of the clap, the very first clap sound and hi-hat sound from Rapper's Delight. So you have like the prime hip-hop song being sampled in this Slum Village tune with this very rare and ridiculous vocalese, you know, song from Singers Unlimited. So these two things work together to give this very, very woozy rhythmic feeling. Right. So that is the first technique. That's deceleration.
Now what we be at, if we let you do that, we probably be laying on our backs. Talking this and that, you want my, you plan ya, it was whack. I never would.
To come back to the album and how it was received, because this to me was always one of the most interesting albums of the late 90s, given the amount of as I've been saying, the amount of hype that was behind it. And in 2016, for Q Point, writer Martin Caballero quotes T3 about how Q-Tip inadvertently set the group up for very, very heavy scrutiny. And this is T3 speaking here. Quote, "The only thing that hurt us was when Q-Tip said he was passing the torch to us on Hold Tight. Before we even got out the gate, a lot of diehard Tribe fans who were reporters and stuff like that, they trashed the album based on that line," unquote.
"Too slimy, liable to make this piece, brother, turn grimy. I'ma leave it in the hands of the slum now. Take it away from where it comes from now. A lot of you cats in the music business, shiftless, I put you on the shit list."
And, you know, I don't remember if I trashed Slum Village, but I certainly did think, because hearing someone of Q-Tip stature basically saying, "I'm passing the torch on, right? This is the next people. This is supposed to be the next Tribe." That sets up insane expectations. And I know Q, you know, meant well. It wasn't like he was trying to set them up for failure. But I recall very distinctly back then thinking, okay, so if they're supposed to be that good, let's see what they have. It is in some ways, you could say, similar to how the Source crowned Nas as the Second Coming. But the main difference is that I don't think Fantastic Volume 2 was received in the way that Illmatic was, as proof of concept. If anything, Fantastic Volume 2 had tremendous expectations that were going to be almost impossible to be met, I think, under even the best of circumstances. And the fact that it got delayed, you know, roughly, what, a year and a half or more, I don't think did the album any favors, because my feeling is, had Fantastic Volume 2 originally come out when it was supposed to, which would have been early, like first quarter 1999, it was a slightly different moment where I think what they're doing sonically would have been better received compared to that same album being dropped in 2000, when you're now in the midst of like just Blaze is in the game heavy now. Timbaland is basically running the show in different ways. And something like Slum Village doesn't quite fit into that mix in the same way that I think it would have had it come out a couple years prior.
You know, to me, I get why. And I will say this, you know, what had happened was they signed, Q-Tip wanted to sign Slum Village.
Mm.
And they turned Q-Tip down for a deal with A&M. Mm. And it was probably a good thing, because Q-Tip really wasn't a record entrepreneur. He had a production company called Mr. Incognito. So this is a very painful moment in some ways for James with his mentor. Not painful, but uncomfortable.
Sure, of course.
They ended up signing to A&M, where John McClain essentially did the deal and then handed it off to an A&R person named Junior Regisford, another beautiful guy from New York originally, very much attuned to the culture. He thought that Slum Village was Tribe on steroids. He paired them with Corrupt, you know, to do sort of a West Coasty feeling kind of song, and that was the first version of Fourth and Back, which is amazing. Ladies and gents, I gotta get the money, so off paying rent and off a payment. I'm down to buy it, say word. And if it ain't right, don't try it. We all masters, like NASA to the astronaut, making sure the shit's hot. Yours is not. My menu need a pit stop. This guy, women giving up the. Who's that? She said she liked the. Junior Register, the A&R guy, sees this. It's just this great thing. And of course, as you know, the wheels of macroeconomics are churning, and A&M is about to be folded into Interscope, and Junior Register is going to lose his job. And so this disc, unreleased, ends up in a pile on Jimmy Iovine's desk. And one of the folks at Interscope in this period of limbo, her name is Karen Rackman, and she was like the big music supervisor of the time, right, of that period in the mid to late 90s. And so Karen Rackman fell in love with this song called Get This Money. Hey, hey, what you say? Get this money. If it's late, what you gonna do today? Just say, hey, I wanna get paid. Hey, 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 hey. Which was a sample of a Herbie Hancock song, and she had worked for Herbie Hancock, so she loved it. Mm-hmm. And she decided to put it on her soundtrack for this Mike Judge movie called Office Space.
Samira and I are the best programmers they got at that place. And you haven't been showing up, and you get to keep your job.
Actually, I'm being promoted.
What?
I know, Michael. It's completely unfair. For 5 years now, you've worked your ass off at Intertech, hoping for a promotion or some kind of profit sharing or something.
So that one single on Interscope becomes their very first release.
Yeah.
All of it is just kind of amazing, and it's the only thing that makes it out. The source, even though the album isn't out, the source ends up running a review that's only 3.5 mics. It really breaks James's heart, even though I know it probably wouldn't have talked about it in that way. But I think he lost. It just wasn't a good look for him, mm-hmm. he felt. And then, as the story goes, Jimmy Iovine said, well, I know I said I would put this out, but I just hired this new guy named Steve Stout. And he needs to, you know, say it's okay. And, of course, you know, Steve Stout said, I don't really get it. And so then Slum Village, but he wouldn't release them either.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want them to blow up somewhere else. So they're in limbo. And how this album gets saved is a young man by the name of Matt Kahane, who has a small indie label based in the Bay Area called Good Vibe.
Good Vibe Records.
And I think, yeah, so you know, right? Yeah. So they had, I think they had Defari and a few other artists. And he, Matt Kahane, because of his successful regional singles, he signed a deal with this, the very first internet-only record company, Atomic Pop. And they gave him a whole bunch of money to sign some stuff. And he signed Bahamadia from Philly.
Right.
And he signed Slum Village. And as soon as he signed Slum Village, that's when they dropped the bomb on him that JD is no longer interested in being in the group, but he will help out as much as he can. They somehow managed to get 4 new songs created for this next version. And it finally comes out, I think, in June of 2000. Essentially, you know, at least 2 years after they, a little more than 2 years after they first started making the album in 98.
Right, right.
And more than three years after Fantastic Volume 1 came out. I mean, no wonder James wanted to be rid of it. It's really frustrating.
Yeah. Fake niggas need to put them away. You know, people say shit about you and me. What's up with this jealousy? So let's get into what I imagine might be a very difficult question to answer, which is, what is your fire track off of Fantastic Volume 2?
Well, I got my moment and I got my fire track.
My fire track
would be since I know that O-Dub likes Fall in Love, and that is that's the anthem off this album. That is the Slum Village JD national anthem. That's the one that, you know, you sort of stand erect for, put your hand over your heart. Since I'm approaching this musicologically, the song for me that is the most important and really tells the biggest tale is a song called Untitled. Mm. It begins almost in nothingness, this sort of quiet, you know, crickets chirping. And this heartbeat starts.
Yo, all it to me, fucking cash about the sleeve. Yeah, I'ma show you.
And then the crack of that snare. But the snare comes in too early. So you're automatically, you launch into this very lopsided, jarring kind of beat against which these three MCs are all doing these rhythmic acrobatics. Of course, another thing that James loved to do that is super duper hip hop is he would do DJ dropouts on his songs. You know, when you mute the record, right, just so the crowd can say something, he would do that at sort of odd places.
Don't you conceive this, just sit back, breathe. I got more where this come from. JD, the original drum master. You will never hit the best, fast or slow, it doesn't matter though.
You know, like you noted, you know, for me, my fire track, and this has been the same since the very, very beginning, is Fall in Love. But before we get to that, real quick, I do want to give a shout out to what would be like a close 1B choice, which is I Don't Know. And this was a song that was originally created for the Fantastic Volume 1, you know, quasi demo tape's last album that you mentioned earlier. And I don't recall if I actually heard this before Fall in Love. I do know that between those two songs, those are the two tracks that made the biggest impression on me initially. And they're very, very different. And what I love about I Don't Know is just, besides the cleverness of using James Brown samples, vocal samples, in so many different ways to integrate it into the actual songwriting, it just has this swing and this feel to it that it just brings so much energy right out the gate in a way that's unexpected. And we've been talking about the element of surprise that exists in a lot of these songs.
You could ask my man T. I ain't the to be play like the niggas that used to play.
It is everything that you said it is. And of course, the wonderful thing about this version of the song is that the most sublime moment on this album, the moment that encapsulates my own personal revelation with JD and this album as an executive, as a producer, as a fan, is the last 10 seconds of this song, when the beat suddenly cuts out to reveal the sample beneath it. And the sample is in threes. It's in like 12/8 time. And you don't expect it. You don't hear it under this hard 4/4 beat. That's a sample of Baden-Powell's ESOI. And it's decelerated. If you listen to the original, it's super duper fast. And how in the world did he even think to take this part, slow it down, put it against that beat, and make that? That's genius.
Again, I just love all the deep diving here. And to cycle back to what you were saying earlier around the anthem off the album, and this is my fire track, it also is my favorite moment from the album, Fall in Love is just unqualifiably, you know, first ballot, Hall of Fame, just one of my all-time favorite songs. And it's a combination of, I love any song that begins with a really good cracking drum break, but it's the favorite moment part is the 1-2, which then introduces us to the Gap Mangione sample that powers the main melody of the song.
1-2-2-2-2. 1-2-2.
I think one of the things that really pops out to me, actually, there's two things that pop out to me just re-listening to it right now. And this is something that had always tickled me in the back of my head, but now it makes much more sense, is that, is that JD saying 1-2? I actually don't even know who says 1-2 on there.
Yep.
Okay, it is Dilla. He's not saying it when you expect him to say it. Like, if you were to count down 1-2, it would expect it to happen about a fraction of a beat later. And he's always a little bit off. So no matter how many times I hear it, my brain says when 1-2 is supposed to come in, it always actually comes in like, again, half, like not even half a beat, like a quarter beat before that. And I guess, and again, this kind of speaks to your point about him playing with the distortions of time, unsettling us, right? But I think the other quality about it is it manages something that I don't think is as easy as we perhaps imagine it to be, is that it merges the hard and the soft in a way where I think a lot of great kind of soft hip hop songs are just soft all the way. You think of like Electric Relaxation by Tribe Called Quest. And I'm not saying it lacks like that boom back factor. It's there, but it's not cracking in the way that the drum break on here is cracking. But what Fall in Love has is just the pillowy, cottony softness of that Gap Mangione sample. And to have those two things operating at once creates this dichotomy that just, I think, makes it so very unique. If you had to describe Fantastic Volume 2 in three words, what three words would you choose?
T3, Botten, and JD.
There you go.
Yep.
Once again, happy birthday to JD, who would have turned 47 this week. If you've enjoyed these snippets of conversations that you've just finished listening to, you can find the full episodes in our archives. Just go to heatrockspod.com. You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. On a more somber note, we want to acknowledge the passing of Double K, the other half of People Under the Stairs, who unfortunately passed away at the age of 43 at the end of January. Rest in peace.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.